The Tom Woods Show, episode 2273.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey, everybody, we all know it is time for us to break up, but everybody's status quo bias is standing in the way of this obvious and humane solution. Check out my brand new ebook called National Divorce, The Peaceful Solution to Irreconcilable Differences, which you can get for free at nationaldivorce.com. Hey, everybody, Tom Woods here. Kevin Gutzman is back with us because how could we possibly cover this gigantic tome in a mere one episode? We're talking about Kevin's latest book, The Jeffersonians, The Visionary Presidencies of Jefferson, Madison, and Monroe. Kevin is, as I've said in the past, the kind of person nobody wants to debate. The historians don't want to debate him because he has a law degree. The lawyers don't want to debate him because he's a history PhD. He knows more than any of them about any of this stuff. And when it comes to the Jeffersonians, there's nobody else I would want to talk to. So Kevin, welcome back.
Happy to be back, Tom.
Let's start with, given that last time, I'll link on the show notes page to our previous conversation about the book. Last time, as you said, we talked only really about the Jefferson administration. I want to talk about Madison Monroe here. But before we do that, when I think of the word Jeffersonian, really two major things come to mind. And that would be local self-government. So the 10th Amendment would be an example of that. And also a strict construction of the Constitution. But what else would you say is a necessary ingredient in Jeffersonianism? Like, how do we distinguish somebody as being a Jeffersonian from somebody who isn't, apart from just those two things? Or is it just those two things?
Well, those are the main ideological commitments. But Jefferson also thought, of course, that there should be freedom of conscience. That, for example, in Connecticut, where I lived, they had still the Puritan establishment on which the colony had been founded. And he wrote the famous letter to the Danbury Baptists explaining that Americans were generally committed to this principle that the Republicans in Connecticut, that is people who weren't prominent in the Puritan church, should have equal civic rights. So this was something that was still contested in some states, most notably Connecticut, but not only Connecticut. And people understood at the time that Jefferson stood for that, freedom of conscience. Jefferson also had the idea that, of course, eventually slavery should go away. And this was something that Madison and Monroe also were voted to. And very significant steps against slavery were taken by Jefferson and Monroe in particular that eventually set it on the road to extinction. One was, of course, Jefferson's 1806 State of the Union Address called on Congress to pass legislation exercising its power to ban slave imports beginning in 1808. And so in 1807, Congress passed a bill to do that, and Jefferson signed it into law. And that meant that at the crack of 1808, it became illegal to import people into slavery in the United States. So very large number of fewer slaves than otherwise would have been ultimately in the United States, therefore were transported here and born here. That was a very significant step. Then, of course, in the Monroe administration, there was a big argument about admitting Missouri into the Union. And President Monroe had the problem that people in the Virginia General Assembly didn't like the idea of bringing Missouri into the Union with an exclusion of slavery. And Monroe himself was, I show at the beginning of the book, somebody who had not thought that much about the question, but then faced with it, decided for reasons I show in the beginning of the book that he would like to see slavery ultimately go away in Virginia. He would like the day to come when there wasn't slavery. And I discuss his coming to that conclusion in the beginning of 1801 when he was governor of Virginia. So faced with this political difficulty in Virginia over the question of his own re-election as president, what Monroe ended up doing was kind of flouting the will of his home state assembly and taking John C. Calhoun's, his war secretary's advice to go ahead and sign the Missouri Compromise into law. Calhoun's position was that the most important thing about the Missouri crisis was to get it over with, because Calhoun said this could be the end of the Union. And to him, that was a more important issue than assuring the spread of slavery into the Louisiana Territory. So Monroe took that advice and signed this into law. And I think the account of it I give is a little bit different from what people have probably been told. Actually, one of the interesting things about the Monroe administration is, of course, that Monroe, unlike Jefferson and Madison, wasn't deeply educated. His was not a finely polished intellect. And the reason was that when he was an 18-year-old freshman at William & Mary, the revolution began. So he and most of his classmates dropped out of school and joined the Continental Army. And Monroe never was able to make up that defect in his upbringing. But what he did when he was president was that he chose two brilliant people to be his chief cabinet officers. One was John Quincy Adams, son of the second president, and the other one was Calhoun, who had been, by that point, a significant member of the House of Representatives. So a large part of the story of the Monroe administration is discussion among the three of them about policy choices. I think you can think of the other cabinet officers in the Monroe administration as being kind of side bit players. And the real action is what's going on among the three of those people. It's hard to think of a recent cabinet that's had two such brilliant leading members as Calhoun and Adams. So,
what, are you kidding me? We got Buttigieg. Who else? Get out of here. Right. I hear he speaks multiple languages, Kevin.
Yes. Well, actually, I think John Quincy Adams knew seven European languages besides English. And that may be in addition to Greek and Latin. I can't recall, but yeah, I don't think anybody in the current cabinet is going to be on the same intellectual level as Calhoun and Quincy Adams.
All right, let me ask you something. Let's go to James Madison. I want to ask you something about Madison. So you wrote an article a long time ago for a journal called Continuity. I think that's, was that what it was?
Yes.
Okay, about this vexed question about Madison that we don't strictly have to get into here because we don't, chronologically in this book, we don't reach the nullification crisis. But the issue was, here you have James Madison, who in 1798 drafts the Virginia Resolutions and clearly seems to indicate that the states have a constitutional role when it comes to preventing unconstitutional measures from passing. It's not just a matter of letting the courts decide, but the states also have to play a role. But then when you have the nullification crisis in the 1830s, then Madison is dead set against that. And so some people have wondered, was he consistent or not? And there are scholars who say, well, actually, he is consistent if you follow this convoluted line of argument. Others say he was not consistent. Well, there's another thing where there's a at least alleged lack of consistency that does fall within the chronological range of the book, and that is where Madison stood on the National Bank in the 1790s and where he stood on it when he was president. And what I think you said last time was that there was an opinion among some people that if a constitutional interpretation holds for long enough and the public has not repudiated it in any way, then it's at least arguable that that's a plausible reading of the Constitution. So this may explain why Madison, who opposed the bank all those years earlier, was in favor of it when he was president. How else can we make sense of this?
Well, that is what Madison said. In fact, you find an argument to that effect over what Publius calls this idea, quote-unquote, liquidation of the Constitution. That is, the Constitution is just words on paper, and what it means in particular circumstances is going to be decided by a course of experience. So, in other words, Madison thinks that there can't be a situation in which the meaning of every part of the Constitution is always an open question. So the idea is that you'll implement it, and over time, if it's generally accepted that provision X has meaning number one, then people eventually should feel bound by that course of interpretation. Does that make sense?
Yes.
So Madison, of course, was forthrightly opposed to Hamilton's bank. But then when he was president, he reasoned that although he had been opposed to it, a long sequence of presidents and congresses had accepted its existence. And so this matter had been liquidated. That's the way he explained it. Now, you and I can find that persuasive or not, but as a historian, I think I've captured his argument.
Can you say something also about, I mean, I'm afraid if we delve too deeply into the War of 1812, the whole episode will be the War of 1812. So I am sort of picking out quirkier items that are nevertheless of interest to me and I hope to people listening, but the veto of the bonus bill is such a beautifully drafted statement in the way that I think the Kentucky Resolutions of 1798 is a beautiful encapsulation of Jefferson's view of the Union. And yet you read it and it sounds like it was written on Venus or something. It seems like it bears no connection whatsoever to American life in 2023. None. It's like it's really, this would be like a caveman who's been in ice for, you know, it's like the unfrozen caveman lawyer from Saturday Night Live. Well, first of all, just comment on that. Tell us exactly what is his argument in that bonus bill veto? And how long would you say in American history that kind of analysis is still to be heard coming from a White House?
Boy, well, according to John C. Calhoun's 1843 campaign biography, which we now know was co-authored by Virgil Maxey and Calhoun himself, on the last day of the Madison administration, Calhoun went to visit the president because he had heard a rumor that Madison was going to veto the bonus bill. The bonus bill was a bill in which Congress attempted to spend the money that it would get from the so-called bonus, that is, that would come into the federal government's coffers because the federal government was a part owner of the Bank of the United States. The Bank of the United States was going to make a profit, and what should we do with the money? And the idea of the bonus bill was that Calhoun had said in Congress, we could bind the nation together by providing a network of roads, canals, and bridges that were funded by the federal government with this money from the Bank of the United States. And Madison's argument was, well, this is just unconstitutional. So he wrote a lengthy veto message, which is a kind of constitutional valedictory, in which he said essentially what Jefferson had said and Madison had said in response to Hamilton's bank bill in the House and in the cabinet, that there was nothing in the Constitution that empowered Congress to spend money to build roads, canals, and bridges, that the arguments people had made about the necessary and proper clause or the general welfare clause or whatever other provision of the Constitution Hamiltonian inclined people might point to were specious. And the Constitution was based on the, in general, was based on the principle that the federal government only had the powers that had been delegated. That is the 10th Amendment. So Madison vetoed it. Now you might think, well, didn't his calling for chartering a new bank vitiate this argument? But again, this idea of liquidation only applied to particular questions, right? So Madison didn't think that what he thought of as the reality that the people and the political actors had generally agreed that Congress had power to charter a bank, that meant a Hamiltonian approach to the Constitution was appropriate in every regard, right? It only answered that one question. So as far as he was concerned, it remained the case that Congress didn't have the constitutional authority to spend money, build roads, canals, and bridges throughout the country. And so it was unconstitutional. Did that answer your question?
Yeah, I think so. But I guess it's like today, the idea that that would even come up.
Oh, right, right.
Although, on the other hand, like as recently as the 1950s, the Eisenhower administration felt obligated to give a constitutional rationale for the national highway system. And they said it would contribute to national defense because it could be used as a means of evacuation in case of a nuclear attack. So they felt some obligation to say something.
Right. There's actually a chapter on that in Woods and Gutzman, Who Killed the Constitution.
Yeah. Well, how about that? As a matter of fact, there is.
So, well, I think back in the 70s, there were people who made this kind of argument in connection with creating the Department of Education, I seem to recall. So I think actually a large number of those people were Democrats, mostly from the South, who were making that argument in Congress as recently as my teenage years in the 1970s. And I don't recall exactly how President Carter answered that argument, but it certainly is the case now that we essentially don't hear people saying we shouldn't fund PBS because where did we get authority to fund PBS?
Right.
Yeah.
It's just not there.
Right.
One completely irrelevant, well, somewhat irrelevant thing that I want to ask you about from the Madison years, and then I want to get back to constitutional questions, is this matter of the year without a summer, that this was indeed my first time encountering this, 1816. No, it's not a pressing matter in American history, but it's an interesting curiosity that most of us don't know about. What did you find about this?
Well, there was an enormous volcanic eruption in what is now Indonesia. And what it did was cover much of the Northern Hemisphere with ash and soot for months. And so there essentially was not summer in Northern Europe or Canada or New England or much of the Midwest that year. So there were spectacular instances of major rivers just being frozen solid, not only in Northern Europe, but in the United States. So one of the most obvious illustration is that in Pittsburgh, apparently the Monongahela was frozen, and where it's normally 25 or 30 feet deep, it was only 3 feet deep and people walked across it. It just completely wrecked, of course, the entire agricultural economy of the country that year. And there was starvation in some of the United States that year as a result of this, which nobody could see coming.
I just wanted you to say something about that because I had been completely unaware of this. And so it's just an interesting side note about what was going on. But yet there's no official acknowledgement of anything like this in any federal document or in correspondence of these people, is there? Or is there?
No, there's really not.
Yeah, very strange.
I actually learned of this in writing this book. And I had, as that of course implies, that I hadn't heard of it before, which is very odd to me. But right, it was a major development, of course, in the lives of Americans that year. So people who lived through the Madison administration and into the Monroe administration all experienced this terrible economic dislocation that resulted from this. Yes.
Why does Monroe win so decisively?
Well, actually, Jefferson in his first inaugural address, with which the book starts and to which I devote substantial attention, says he hopes that the party animosity of the 1790s can be put behind. We've called by different name brethren of the same principle. We're all Republicans. We're all Federalists. And people had the idea that that should be the case. And the Republican administrations, the Republican program proved so popular that the Federalist Party basically ceased to exist. So I mentioned Quincy Adams earlier, who was, of course, Monroe's Secretary of State and who before that had been a U.S. Senator. He was a former Federalist, moved over into the Republican camp during the War of 1812 because of the New England Federalists' basically suicidal attitude about that war, politically self-destructive attitude about that war. And there were other people who did that for that same reason. But for the most part, the Jefferson administration obtained gigantic amounts of virgin territory for Americans to farm if they wanted to. They slashed taxes. They got rid of essentially all internal taxes, federal taxes. And what more could you want? And of course, they wrongly got credit for, quote unquote, winning the War of 1812, which I show in the book was just incompetently run by the Madison administration, largely because Madison made hideously bad appointments of people to the cabinet posts. In those days, there were two cabinet posts related to the military, the Secretaryship of War and the Secretaryship of the Navy. And the people who were in the main positions as generals, except for William Henry Harrison and Andrew Jackson, were just incompetent, beyond incompetent, just terribly, awfully horrible. So the public ended up not really having any attraction to the Federalists at all. In fact, one illustration of that is that in Connecticut today, I'm speaking from Connecticut, in Connecticut today, we live under the Constitution of 1818. And what that was about was getting rid of the old Puritan establishment in Connecticut, which was also the social elite in Connecticut. And Connecticut was, I think, the only state that voted against Jefferson every time he was a presidential candidate. Maybe Delaware did too. But after the abolition of the old standing order in Connecticut, there was essentially nothing about the Federalists left. That had been the local institutional or establishment that underlay Federalist social authority in Connecticut and political authority, economic authority. That's symptomatic of what happened to the Federalist establishments in other states. Most states that had been dominated by the Federalist Party had similar kinds of social, religious, and economic elites. And over time, in the Federalist era, they just ceased to be elite. They ceased to dominate.
Hey, folks, quick sponsor message. You have problems. My sponsor, Persist SEO, has solutions. So, problem, you're getting buried by your competition online. Solution, build your brand, your reputation, and your lead flow with digital marketing by Persist SEO. Problem, you're a small local business and you're trying to compete against large companies in the service industry. Solution, increase visibility with Persist SEO. What about low or no leads coming in on a consistent basis? That's death for a business. So the solution is website search engine and conversion optimization that can help move the needle to a more prosperous business model for you. Problem, you're not showing up on the search engines for your services in your area. Solution, get found with Persist SEO's expert search engine optimization. And there are so many other ways Persist SEO can help you. All you have to do is call 770-580-3736 or visit them at ineedseo.help for a free website audit and consultation. That's 770-580-3736 or ineedseo.help. What's going on with the Supreme Court during these years? What would be a couple of the, let's say, landmark decisions that might have undermined the Jeffersonian project?
Well, when Jefferson was inaugurated as president, he took the oath of office from his cousin, John Marshall. Both of them were Randolphs on their mother's sides. And actually, the Randolph family is the most important family in American history. There were a lot of other important Randolphs too. But essentially, the two of them disagreed entirely about the Constitution. And that reflected the fact that John Marshall had been the last Federalist Secretary of State. And before that, he'd been a Federalist Congressman. And before that, he'd been a Federalist in the Virginia Ratification Convention. And while these Jeffersonians and their party allies ran the executive branch in the Congress, Marshall and his majority still ran the federal Supreme Court. And so what they did during this period was they wrote Hamiltonianism into quote-unquote constitutional law. So today, if in America you study constitutional law, you start essentially with Marbury versus Madison, in which Chief Justice Marshall and his court claimed for federal courts power of judicial review. And then the next case you consider is McCulloch versus Maryland, in which they basically said that Congress had legislative discretion as broad as Hamilton could have hoped. So even though the opposite idea from that, from McCulloch, was ruling the day, and as we said a couple of minutes ago, the Federalist Party really ceased to exist, Hamiltonianism lives on because that decision, that reasoning, the majority opinion from Marshall and McCulloch is still the starting point for federal judges saying how the Constitution should be understood. So there are several cases, several of the main cases one reads in law school in studying constitutional law that were decided during this time. And I give them attention, substantial attention, because I think the reasoning is really worthy of elaboration. And because party actors at the time were decrying them with great volume, maybe only in private, but with great volume. Besides which, the chief judge of the Virginia, what's now called the Virginia Supreme Court, was writing editorial columns in the main newspaper in the South, maybe in the whole country, the Richmond Inquirer, arguing against what Chief Justice Marshall was saying. So most Virginians, certainly Republicans, that is Jeffersonian Republicans, were persuaded that Marshall was just entirely wrong. But even if 99% of the general public thinks that the Supreme Court is entirely wrong, as we know, there's nothing the general public can do about it except appoint somebody they hope will behave differently in case one of them dies or retires. So that's a really odd element of the history of this period. Jefferson said that he thought this was the great flaw in the Constitution, that there was nothing the people could do about what Marshall and his majority were doing. At one point, he became very frustrated that his appointment of people, of a couple of people to the Supreme Court, didn't seem to have changed the way the court was behaving much at all. So he actually wrote, nowadays, this would be considered entirely improper, but in those days, they didn't have these ethical constraints. So Jefferson wrote in retirement, former President Jefferson wrote a letter to one of his Supreme Court appointees and said, "What is this that you're doing? How is it that no matter what new material we put into the loaf, the bread comes out the same. And he said, I can't believe that the Supreme Court continues to issue these rulings that just seem fatuous to me. And the guy wrote back to him and said, well, I don't think any of our constitutional decisions are really wrong. Could you tell me which one's mistaken? And so Jefferson wrote him just an endless letter laying out his disagreements with all of the major decisions of the Supreme Court. And this guy, Johnson, who was from South Carolina and was a Republican, said to him in response, well, okay, from now on, I will dissent. They had come to have a kind of a custom on the Supreme Court when John Marshall
was unanimous decisions, right?
Yeah, they would have just one decision and nobody would dissent. Nobody would write a concurrence. Nowadays, we think they have nine justices. Sometimes they actually have cases in which there are nine separate opinions. So they don't even have what they call a majority opinion, although they have to decide the case. But they've reached the opposite point now where sometimes you can't even figure out what the quote-unquote law that a particular decision has established is, because the descriptions of it in the various opinions you get are so different from each other. What has the court agreed on? That's the question. Anyway, in those days, they would go entire terms with every opinion the court issued having been written by Chief Justice Marshall. So Jefferson is very annoyed about this, and he writes to Justice Johnson. And as I said, finally, Justice Johnson says, well, okay, from now on, if I have a disagreement, I will write a dissenting opinion. So Justice Johnson is remembered as the great dissenter. And here's a little bit of perspective. Sometimes he would dissent once in a term or twice in a term, and that made him the great dissenter. Well, today, if he were on the Supreme Court and he only dissented twice in a term, people would say, what is wrong with you? Don't you want to write opinions? How come you're never saying you don't agree? Or how come you're never writing a concurrence? Do you have the same reasoning as majority in every case? It doesn't even make sense. But in those days, it was just Marshall's court. People refer to it as Marshall's court. It really was Marshall's court in a way that's totally lost on us now. So there's a lot of political blowback to this in Virginia. And there are multiple episodes in which Virginia courts, the Virginia, what is now called the Virginia Supreme Court, butts heads with the U.S. Supreme Court. In one famous case, the Supreme Court said, in an opinion by Marshall, essentially, well, the Constitution establishes a system in which ultimately the U.S. Supreme Court is supreme when it comes to matters of federal law. So send us your record of this case. And so if you study constitutional law, that case, which is called Merton versus Hunter's Lessee, stands for the idea that the federal Supreme Court can tell state Supreme Courts what to do in federal cases that have arisen in state courts. But the Virginia Supreme Court never did what it was told to do in that case. So they just flouted Marshall's order. So there really is serious headbutting going on here in a way that we nowadays we would think is completely impermissible. The last time we had this was when President Eisenhower ended up sending in the National Guard into Little Rock, right? That was the last example of this kind of thing. Of course, in that case, the state authorities, I think, were wrong. But in these cases in the Jeffersonian period, often they were right. And they had reason to be decrying what Marshall was doing. In some of these cases, it's just impossible for me to see why you would accept what Marshall had said.
Well, I think it's safe to say that if we look at the cases during Marshall's tenure, that with the exception of Barron versus Baltimore, to the extent that states' rights are involved, the decision is always in favor of the federal government.
That's right. In every constitutional case that had to do with state and federal authority, except for Barron, he sided with the federal government.
So, you know, I once thought, until I found out about the customary unanimous decisions of at least the early 19th century, but I still think it's a good idea for later than that, would be a book, maybe there is such a book, Kevin, but called Great Dissents. And not even necessarily great because we've heard of them. We probably haven't heard of a lot of the really good dissents, but great because the arguments are great. Because I've thought, I wonder what some of the justices who were against the New Deal and sort of became in the minority as the years went on, I wonder what they were saying in various decisions. Or I could think of terrible decisions from the past 50, 60 years where I'm sure the dissent was excellent. I mean, Clarence Thomas has had some great dissents. Scalia, I think there is a book of his dissents.
Yes,
there is. You can read. Mm-hmm. But I would love to, I think it would almost be a great primary source for U.S. history to collect some of these great dissents. So if only there were more of them during this period.
Well, there are books of great dissents, but what they tend to be are aggressive dissents that foreshadow what will happen
right
during the New Deal.
So, right. So they're great from the point of view of the
dealers, yes.
Yeah. The point of view of progressivism and stuff like that.
That's right.
Now, as we look at this material in 2023, what specifically in 2023 would you say we ought to draw from it? I mean, we don't read history specifically because we think it's going to solve our problems today. I know people think that there are lessons of history, and indeed, I suppose there are some, but they're not always neatly potted little lessons that we can easily draw. And sometimes circumstances are different enough that it's too hard to draw any, quote, lessons. But yet, this is our country, so it's not like I'm looking to ancient Sumerians for inspiration. I am looking at Americans who operated under the U.S. Constitution. You'd think there'd be something of relevance for today that I could pull out of it. And so what would you say these three men are saying to us today, if anything?
Well, one thing that I show in the book is that the cartoon version of them we've heard over the last two or three years is just mistaken. So some of what contemporary critics of these people think should have been hot issues in their minds actually were. They actually acted on them in significant ways. And one of those is slavery. I show in the book that all three of these fellows and some of their political supporters were concerned over this question of what's going to happen in regard to slavery. And contrary to what one might have inferred from various noises of the last three or four years, they weren't supporters of slavery. They weren't people who wanted to expand slavery. They took substantial steps. Jefferson and Monroe in particular took substantial steps to cabin in slavery. And as I said before, Monroe said in an episode at the very beginning of my story that he hoped slavery eventually would no longer exist in Virginia, which you might think, if all you knew were what you had heard in the media in the last few years, would never have come to his mind. And the same thing was true of Jefferson. Jefferson, as president, we talked about a few minutes ago, took substantial steps against slavery. And there were others that we haven't talked about. So this is important because I think a large part of what goes on in contemporary popular culture in particular is people are just trying to make the young people in the United States hate the country. And they have reasons for wanting to make them do that, none of which I think are positive. So having a dispassionate account of this period, I think, can help to remedy that problem. And that's part of what I hope the book will accomplish.
Well, I think it very much does that. I will say that on the show notes page, which is tomwoods.com/2273, there I will have a link to all your, there's a lot of them, Kevin, all your previous appearances. And I know we did an episode on Jefferson and slavery that I think people will find interesting. They definitely didn't learn this material in school. What they got was the usual stuff said about Jefferson. So the book is, and the book, of course, will also be linked to the show notes page, The Jeffersonians, The Visionary Presidencies of Jefferson, Madison, and Monroe, by our wonderful friend and outstanding historian, Kevin Gutzman. That's G-U-T-Z-M-A-N. You can also check him out at kevingutzman.com. By the way, the benefit of having an advanced reader copy is that you get a copy before the general public, and I'm very grateful for that. The drawback is there's no index, and it's a huge book, and I would love to look things up, and it is impossible. But that's okay. I'm more than grateful to have this thing. But in prepping for this, I thought, let me just flip to his discussion of, no index. That is okay. That's okay. You folks, when you go out and buy your copy, which I know you will, there will be an index waiting there for you. I just can't help asking, though, as we wrap up, given how massive this is, how long did a project like this take you? I can't remember.
Well, I started writing it before Thomas Jefferson Revolutionary was published, and that came out in 2017. That is, I started doing the research specifically for this book before that book came out in 2017. But, of course, it draws on the work I've been doing ever since, I don't know, 1992. I wrote things in graduate school at UVA that are cited in this book. So it's a kind of culmination of all the work I've done since I decided to be a historian, really.
I think it's incredibly obnoxious when you have an author on, you ask, so what are you going to work on now? I always wanted to smack people in the face. What are you kidding me? I'm exhausted. I don't want to work. I didn't want to think about what my next project is, but I can't help asking, because just because you and I are friends, if you do have something in mind, I mean, I just wouldn't, if I'd done this book, I just don't know how much I'd have left in the tank. I would need to take a break for a while.
Well, what happened here was when I finished writing Thomas Jefferson Revolutionary, before it was published, I said to my editor at St. Martin's, okay, I want a contract for my next book. And he said, don't you want to take a break? Because that one took 3 years. And I'm the kind of person who, if he has a commitment, can't do anything without thinking I should be working on that, so that I couldn't go watch my kids' sports games or whatever without thinking I should be working on my book. So I got a new contract, and it took me 5+ years to write this, which meant when I finished it, I had been 8 years without some, you know, with something hanging over my head. And I decided after I finished this one, I was going to take a break. However, I have begun doing kind of background work for a history of what's called the Revisal of Laws, which in Virginia, when revolution was starting, Jefferson had the idea that they should go through all the colonial statutes and all the colonial court decisions and change them to make them Republican. So products of that effort ended up being his famous statute for religious freedom, a bill for the more general diffusion of knowledge, which would have established a statewide education system for all kids. In fact, at one point, an abolitionist from Pennsylvania said to him, well, what about educating black kids? And he said, if you read my bill, you'll see it doesn't exclude black kids. It just says all children. So there's a big suite of these bills, several of which were ultimately enacted. Of course, that one was not enacted, but creating UVA was part of this effort too. So there's never been a monograph on this subject, unbelievably. And I have started doing work toward that end.
Well, you can take the, I don't know what I was going to try and do. You can take the man out of the, I don't know how that applies here, but I'm glad you still have the energy to be carrying forward. I have profited from everything I've read that you've written. Of course, including the book you and I wrote together, Who Killed the Constitution. But I was reading articles of yours back in the 1990s before we even met. And here you are still out there doing it. So I appreciate that. You are the opposite of Bobby Fischer, who would emerge from obscurity and then play, and then that would be the end of it. But you're still out there cranking it out, and I'm very, very happy about that. I'm happy about the success of this book for you, too. I just read the Wall Street Journal review, which was extremely positive. You know, it's been getting some nice coverage. It's almost like they don't realize you're an extremist.
Yes.
He says humorously.
Don't tell. Well, you can tell from this conversation that I disagree with the general bent of American constitutional law, for one thing. So there's that. And I don't like the statue toppling of the last few years. So I guess these things together make me an extremist, right?
Yeah. What would have been completely normal 10 years ago. All right, Kevin, thanks so much. Again, everybody, pick up a copy of The Jeffersonians, because who else you want to learn your history from? You want to learn from some boring old, you know, establishment hack, or you want to learn it from a truth teller? Check out The Jeffersonians. Thanks, Kevin.
You're welcome.
And thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of The Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at Podsworth.com.